Chapter 21, The Lie of Mutations and Vestigial Organs.
It's been called one of the biggest exterminations in modern history, and it was spawned by a belief in evolution.
It happened to the Aboriginal people in the land down under.
In 1870, an evolutionary anthropologist named Max Müller had divided the human race into seven categories.
And it just so happened that the Aborigines fell at the bottom. And so as a result of this racist, ruthless, and savage view, a terrible massacre began with the goal of exterminating them. Aboriginal heads were nailed over station doors.
Poisoned bread was given to their families. And in many parts of Australia, Aboriginal settlements completely disappeared within just 50 years. But believe it or not, they weren't just killed because they were thought to be an inferior race, they were killed to help support the theory of evolution. Not only the local police, but even the locals, were given instructions on how to rob their graves and plug up bullet wounds in freshly killed specimens. In fact, a New South Wales missionary was horrified to witness a slaughter by mounted police of dozens of Aboriginal men, women and children. 45 heads were then boiled down and the 10 best skulls were packed off overseas for display. In fact, Charles Darwin himself wrote and asked for Tasmanian skulls when only 4 of the island's Aborigines were left alive, provided his request would not upset their feelings.
And believe it or not, the demand has not entirely stopped.
Aboriginal bones have still been sought by major institutions as evidence for evolution. In fact, the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C., still has thousands of them on hand.
Now folks, how many of you guys ever heard of the slaughter of the Aborigines before? Yeah, hardly any of us. And gee whiz, I wonder why? Could it be that the reason the Aboriginal people were treated like animals was evolution? Aha. No wonder you never hear about that, right? And therefore, at this rate, we don't need to call it evolution, we need to call it evolution. Hello. It's not just racist, it's deadly. And people, that's exactly why we're going to continue in our study called, The Witness of Creation. And so far, we've seen the first evidences of creation that God has left behind showing that He's not just real, but that we really can have a personal intimate relationship with Him, the Creator of the universe, were the evidences of an intelligent creation from the very hand of Almighty God, as opposed to blind chance exploding from some sort of primeval blob, and then a young creation, as opposed to the long-age fairy tale time of evolution. And in the last 4 chapters we saw how the third evidence was a special creation. And there we've not only seen how the supposed evolution of people and animals and natural selection is a bunch of baloney, but in the last chapter we saw that embryology was also a bunch of baloney. Why? Because as we saw, it's got some serious problems. It's got problems with the theory, problems with the evidence, problems with the quotes, and problems with the belief. It's actually the justification people use for abortion. And therefore, we concluded that embryology is not only a lie, it's a deadly one. But you might be thinking, okay, so maybe the supposed evolution of people and animals and natural selection and embryology is a bunch of baloney. But what about the other supposed mechanisms they've come up with, like mutations and vestigial organs? Well, hey, great question. But before we look at that, let's once again get reacquainted with the biblical answer for the existence of life.
Jeremiah 27:1-6. Early in the reign of Zedekiah son of Josiah king of Judah, this word came to Jeremiah from the Lord, "This is what the Lord said to me. Make a yoke out of straps and crossbars and put it on your neck. Then send word to the kings of Edom, Moab, Ammon, Tyre and Sidon through the envoys who have come to Jerusalem to Zedekiah king of Judah. Give them a message for their masters and say, 'This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Tell this to your masters: with my great power and outstretched arm I made the earth and its people and the animals that are on it, and I give it to anyone I please. Now I will hand all your countries over to my servant Nebuchadnezzar king of Babylon, I will make even the wild animals subject to him.'"
Now folks, according to our text, the Bible is clear. Once again, God and God alone had the power to do what? To create all of life, right? From the heavens to the humans, right? But once again, what does evolution teach? Do they say that God's the one who stretched out his arm and brought us into being? Are you kidding? They say it was a bunch of luck in some primordial sea, right? Therefore, I'd say we better take a look at not just the scriptural evidence but the scientific evidence of these supposed evolutionary mechanisms of mutations and vestigial organs and see who's telling the truth. How about you? And to help us do that, let's first take a look at mutations. Here's how the basic premise goes.
Evolutionists believe that over millions and billions of years there have been millions and billions of what they call beneficial mutations that have given rise to all the species we see today. For instance, they say an early fish might have accidentally grown a new beneficial kind of fin that helped it swim faster and escape his enemies. Or maybe its fins mutated into legs and it was able to walk on land.
And folks, unless you think I'm making this up, listen to this. Carl Sagan said,
"The evolution of life on Earth is a product of random events, chance mutations, and individually unlikely steps." And evolutionary scientist Theodosius Dobzhansky said, "The process of mutations is the only known source of the new materials of genetic variability, and hence of evolution."
So, my question is this. Is this really true? Are millions and billions of mutations over millions and billions of years what really brought life into being? Are you kidding? People, it's another evolutionary lie. How do I know? Because the first reason we know evolution by way of mutations is a lie is that there are problems with the theory. People, we're going to take a look at some serious problems with this supposed evolution by way of mutations, and you tell me if we haven't been lied to.
The problem of rarity. The only problem with mutations causing all of life to come into being is that in the first place they are extremely rare. In fact, they almost never occur. For instance, even the World Book Encyclopedia said that most genes mutate only once in 100,000 generations or more. Researchers estimate that a human gene may remain stable for 2.5 million years. First of all, as we've seen earlier, we have a young creation of only a few thousand years, and since we haven't been around for 2.5 million years, there hasn't been enough time for mutations to work. But secondly, even if we ignore this and follow the evolutionists' timescale, this extremely rare occurrence of mutations dooms the possibility of ever producing the vast amount of various plant and animal species with millions and millions of characteristics found all over the world. There isn't enough time for mutations to work.
The problem of damage. As we saw earlier, the evolutionists believe that not only mutations have caused evolution to take place, but that these mutations were beneficial. However, nothing could be further from the truth. It is now known that mutations don't help an organism, they damage, mutilate, or kill the organism. For instance, the evolutionists thought they had a major breakthrough in 1928, when X-rays were discovered which would allow them to speed up mutations. Whereas, in nature, there might be one mutation, now they could not only instantly manufacture millions of them, but also focus them on just one organism. They thought for sure they were going to be able to create a whole new species right before their very eyes. The results? Mutations are found not to be beneficial, but detrimental. They harmed, damaged, and weakened the organisms so badly that most of them died, and those that didn't die, their offspring had a tendency to die shortly thereafter. Therefore, because of the damaging effects of mutations, they could never make life evolve into something better, but rather they ensure that death would come to everyone. Just the opposite of evolution. In fact, one person actually has a deformed foot with more toes than normal, 8 to be exact. Is this beneficial? Well, other than having a hard time finding a pair of socks, he can't run any faster. In fact, it probably inhibits his ability to run as well as others, and so guess who gets eaten by the lion first? That's right. Johnny No Socks. Or there are all kinds of deformed frogs out there missing legs. Is this beneficial? Well, he certainly can't hop better, and a one-legged frog has a tendency to hop in circles. Now, even though that's a cool trick, guess who the bird's going to eat first? Or some sheep have actually mutated where one has extremely short and stubby legs. Is he better off? Are you kidding? He's easy prey. When the wolf comes, his friends can yell all they want to run, Sparky, run, but in the end, they'll say, oops. Too bad you had short legs, Sparky. Nice knowing you. Therefore, since mutations are found not to be beneficial, but detrimental, there's no way they could ever cause evolution to happen.
The problem of logic. Evolutionists believe that a purely random mutation, or accident, in a creature, is somehow going to make that creature better. However, let's apply this logic of random accidents elsewhere in life. For instance, if you poked a stick into somebody's bike spokes as they were riding by, would it make their bike ride more enjoyable? No. They'd become road pizza, right? Or if you spontaneously decided to rewire the inside of the TV set at a Super Bowl party, would you be the hit of the game? No. They'd make a game out of hitting you, right? Or how many of you, when you got into an unexpected car wreck, discovered that afterwards your car worked even better than before? No. You found out that your insurance bill went up higher than before, right? Or how about the nuclear accident that occurred at Chernobyl? Surely this should have been an evolutionary paradise, with all that radiation mutating everything, right? Are you kidding? Rather than creating new life, it utterly destroyed life. For instance, after the Chernobyl accident, it caused 800,000 children to see instant medical treatment, the price of the cleanup, and the value of lost farmland and production cost $358 billion. Each passing year brings more and more birth defects among farm animals, colts with eight limbs, animals with deformed lower jaws, and disjointed spinal columns, no eyes, deformed skulls, and distorted mouths, stillbirths, and infant deaths among the animals. What about the people? There has begun a dramatic rise in thyroid disease, anemia, cancer, and an astounding drop in the immunity level of the entire population. And through it all, no new species have come into existence. Only the same ones that have always been there who are now damaged and dying. In fact, the latest death toll caused by Chernobyl is up to 10,000 people. Or how about the atomic bomb? Surely lots of fine new species should have been produced here. Maybe Chernobyl wasn't big enough for mutation. Well, when the atomic bomb of Hiroshima was dropped, it set off a blast with the force of 13,000 tons of TNT and destroyed more than 4.5 square miles of the city, with over 92,000 persons dead or missing. And what of the living who had radiation poured all over their bodies? They were worse off than the dead. They struggled with radiation-damaged bodies through the remainder of their shortened lives, and not one of them evolved into a different species, or a new superrace. Therefore, since mutations don't help an organism, but damage, mutilate, or kill an organism, there's no way they could cause evolution to take place. And I guess that's why geneticist C.H. Waddington said in Science Today, "This is really the theory that strikes me as a lunatic sort of logic, and I think we should be able to do better."
Oh, but that's not all. The second reason we know evolution by way of mutations is a lie is that there's problems with the examples.
Example of the fruit fly. One of the most popular examples of supposed beneficial mutations is the decades of research done on fruit flies. They seemed like ideal candidates. First of all, they breed very rapidly and require little food, and each offspring matures in only a few days. Therefore, the evolutionists believed that what would take mammals tens of thousands of years to accomplish, the humble fruit flies could do within a very short amount of time. In fact, the experiments done on fruit flies have already exceeded the equivalent of a supposed million years of people living on Earth. So, they went right to work, and after decades of study, outside of those that were immediately killed or sterilized, 400 different mutational features were identified in fruit flies. Some had more wings or more eyes or fewer eyes or more legs or fewer legs. And when all was said and done, the fruit fly always remained a fruit fly. After 80 years and millions of generations of fruit flies subjected to X-rays and chemicals which cause mutations, all they have been able to produce are more of the same, fruit flies. In fact, the survivors also tended to revert over succeeding generations back to the original form. Researchers discovered that it was as if some kind of genetic repair mechanism took over and blocked any possibility of evolution. As one guy said, God was very careful in Genesis to state that each of the animals were created after his kind. After 80 years and millions of generations, God was proven right. A fruit fly will always be a fruit fly.
Example of bacteria. Evolutionists are quick to say that certain bacteria have become resistant to certain drugs, and that these resistant strains of bacteria are the result of mutations, showing evolution in action. However, all that was discovered was that bacteria, like other forms of life, can have variations. First of all, some of those bacteria could resist the drugs while others could not. Some of the bacteria survived and some did not. All that the physicians were doing by administering drugs was to breed new, stronger strains of bacteria. Mutations had nothing to do with the process. Secondly, the transfer of resistance genes was already existent in the bacteria, and the building of resistance came as a result of losing genetic data, not gaining it. And thirdly, when all was said and done, bacteria stayed bacteria. That's not evolution.
Example of disease. Believe it or not, evolutionists say that the disease called sickle cell anemia is proof of a beneficial mutation. This is because it has been discovered that a person who has sickle cell anemia is less likely to contract malaria from mosquitoes. But is this really a true benefit? As one guy said, that's like getting your leg chopped off so you can't get athlete's foot. Or it's like saying if you had polio, you're less likely to be killed in an auto accident because you're paralyzed and stuck in a bed. Furthermore, it has been shown that cystic fibrosis and even cancer are a result of a kind of mutated gene. Question: how many of you would volunteer to acquire these diseases so you can live a more beneficial life?
Sin is the reason. What conclusions may be drawn from these few examples, and countless others like them? First, that the human mutation problem is bad and getting worse. Second, that it is unbalanced by any detectable positive mutations. This research affirms the reality of the biblical curse of decay and degeneration on the world of nature, as stated in both the Old and New Testaments. It also highlights the grim reality of the future hopelessness of the human race without the saving intervention of God and His Christ. Mutations continue to slowly harm us. Each generation has a slightly more disordered genetic constitution than the preceding one, and no amount of eugenics can reverse this process of decay. Gene therapy may mask the effects, but it will not reverse the underlying degenerative process. How ironic it is that the byproduct of the fall of man, sin, which is why we have suffering and disease, is now touted by the evolutionists as a good thing.
Oh, but that's still not all. The third reason why we know evolution by way of mutations is a lie is because there are problems with the quotes.
Number 1. George Gaylord Simpson in Uniformitarianism, An Inquiry into Principal Theory and Method in Geohistory and Biochemistry, said, "Most mutations with large effects are lethal at an early stage for the individual in which they occur and hence have zero probability of spreading." Number 2. Herbert Nielsen, in Synthetic Speciation, said, "There is no single instance where it can be maintained that any of the mutants studied has a higher vitality than the mother species. It is, therefore, absolutely impossible to build a current evolution on mutations." Number 3. Pierre-Paul de Grasse, Evolution of Living Organisms, said, "No matter how numerous they may be, mutations do not produce any kind of evolution." Number 4. Julian Huxley, Major Features of Evolution, said, "Obviously, such a process, species change through mutations, has played no part whatever in evolution." 5.
Now folks, I don't know about you, but based on the problems, examples, and quotes we just saw, I'd say somebody's mutated something all right. They've mutated a few of the facts, you know what I'm saying? And gee, that would make this evolution by way of mutations a what? Another big fat lie. Shocker. Oh, but that's not all. As if the lie of mutations wasn't big enough, there's yet another one out there that evolutionists say is genuine proof of evolution in action. It's called vestigial organs. How many of you ever heard of those? Yeah, it's pretty commonplace. And the basic premise goes like this.
Darwin believed that since there seemed to be various organs in animals that were vestigial or unused, that this was proof of evolution. And it's believed that these unused organs in people are actually the leftover remnants of our non-human ancestors. And for proof, they even compiled a list of almost 200 of these supposed unused or vestigial organs. In fact, as recent as 1997, Encyclopedia Britannica said, "The appendix does not serve any useful purpose as a digestive organ in humans, and it is believed to be gradually disappearing in the human species over evolutionary time."
And so here's my question. Is this really true? Are vestigial organs really the leftover remnants of our evolution from animals to people? I don't think so. Why? Because it's yet another evolutionary lie. How do I know? Because the first reason we know evolution by way of vestigial organs is a lie is that there are problems with the theory. People, we're going to take a look at some serious problems with this supposed evolution by way of vestigial organs, and you tell me if somebody hasn't spent too much time staring at monkeys.
The useless problem: the whole theory of vestigial organs assumes that because something appears to be useless, then it is no longer needed. However, think about this logic. You could live without both of your legs and both of your arms, but that doesn't mean you don't need them. Therefore, a supposed useless organ doesn't mean it's not needed. The only thing that's vestigial or useless is this theory.
The ancestor problem. One of the most commonly cited examples of a supposed vestigial organ is the appendix. But as it turns out, humans are not the only ones who have an appendix. So do wombats, rabbits, and opossums. Now, the evolutionary theory of vestiges is based on the concept that your vestigial organs are inherited from a long line of creatures. So, does this mean we evolved from rabbits? And by the way, as it turns out, monkeys don't have an appendix. So how could we have evolved from them, like the evolutionists say? Based on their reasoning, since we have an appendix and monkeys don't, then they must be a higher evolved creature than us, and or have evolved from us, which is just the opposite of what they say.
The degeneration problem. The premise of evolution is that we are evolving into better and stronger creatures over time. However, if you stop and think about it, vestiges or useless organs actually prove degeneration instead of evolution. Useless organs in our bodies would mean we were going backward, not forward. Once again, this is directly opposite to what they say.
The complexity problem. Another point that needs to be considered is this: if man does have nearly 200 vestigial organs, organs that once were functioning, then in the past he would have had more organs than he now has. That means, the farther back we go in time, the more complex the organism becomes. Once again, this is directly opposite to the evolutionary theory.
Oh, but that's not all. The second reason we know evolution by way of vestigial organs is a lie is because there are problems with the examples.
The appendix. Textbooks often say that there are vestigial organs, and again, one of the most common cited examples is the appendix. In fact, evolutionists have suggested it was once part of our herbivore ancestors. But is this organ in our body really useless? Absolutely not. As it turns out, the appendix is a part of our lymphatic system, and therefore affects our immune system, and helps fight against infections. Also, the appendix may boost antibody production in the spleen, and may even play a role in preventing cancer. You can take it out and still live, but that doesn't mean it's useless, or that it's not needed.
The fold in the eye. Charles Darwin said the semilunar fold in your eye was useless. However, it's now known it's needed to cleanse and lubricate your eyeball. Maybe this is what kept him from reading the Bible. He had a crusty eyeball.
The tonsils. Tonsils are also cited as a popular so-called useless organ. However, it is now known that our tonsils serve a valuable purpose. They actually have a significant role in protecting the throat against infections, particularly until adolescence. So much for being useless.
The glands, Believe it or not, various glands in the body are or were once considered absolutely useless by evolutionists, like the thymus, pineal, thyroid, and pituitary glands. However, we know now that the thymus gland enables the T cells to function properly, which protect your body from infection. The pineal gland secretes important hormones, such as melatonin, for proper brain functioning. The thyroid gland is essential to normal body growth and affects our metabolism and body activity. And finally, the pituitary gland acts as a master gland, controlling skeletal growth, proper functioning of the thyroid, adrenals, and reproductive glands. How many of you would still like to have a doctor who believes in vestigial organs?
The wisdom teeth. Some people experience problems with their wisdom teeth, and they have to be removed. Well, evolutionists say it's because we no longer need them, and they are proof of a vestigial organ. But many people still have healthy, useful wisdom teeth. I've got all mine, maybe that's why I talk so fast. Besides, all this shows is that wisdom teeth represent a physical weakness, like failing eyesight, or hardening of the arteries. This does not suggest poor design or uselessness, but a fallen state from perfect creation.
The tailbone. The tailbone or coccyx is yet another popular supposed vestigial organ. However, it is vitally important. It's at the bottom of our spine, and without it you could not only not sit down comfortably, but it also provides an attachment for your pelvic organs, so they will not collapse. It also serves as an anchor for muscles and tendons and plays a role in giving birth, leg movement, and other functions in the lower torso. As one guy said, once I was doing a debate in Huntsville, AL. I was debating the president of the North Alabama Atheist Association. And he got up in front of God and everybody and said, "Folks, we've got proof for evolution. The humans have a tailbone they no longer need." When it was my turn, I got up and I said, "Mr. Patterson, I taught biology and anatomy. I happen to know there are 9 little muscles that attach to the tailbone without which you cannot perform some very valuable functions. I will not tell you what they all are, but trust me, you need those muscles. However, Mr. Patterson, if you think the tailbone is vestigial, I will pay to have yours removed. Bend over." Therefore, it's painfully obvious there are no so-called useless organs in our body.
Oh, but that's still not all. The third reason we know evolution by way of vestigial organs is a lie is because there's problems with the quotes.
Number 1. William Strauss, Quarterly Review of Biology, 1947, said, "There is no longer any justification for regarding the appendix as a vestigial structure." Number 2. P. Ehrlich and R. Holm, The Process of Evolution, 1963, its shortcomings have been almost universally pointed out by modern authors, but the idea still has a prominent place in biological mythology. Number 3. S. Scadding, Evolutionary Theory, 1981, as our knowledge has increased, the list of vestigial structures has decreased. Even the current short list of vestigial structures in humans is questionable. Since it is not possible to unambiguously identify useless structures, and since the structure of the argument used is not scientifically valid, I conclude that vestigial organs provide no special evidence for the theory of evolution. Number 4. Dr. R. L. Wissong noted, "Not too long ago man was imputed to have 180 vestiges. Organs like the appendix, tonsils, thymus, pineal gland and thyroid gland were on the list. Today, all former vestigial organs are known to have some function during the life of the individual. If the organ has any function at any time, it cannot be called rudimentary or vestigial. As man's knowledge has increased, the list of vestigial organs decreased. So what really was vestigial? Was it not man's rudimentary knowledge of the intricacies of the body?"
Now folks, I don't know about you, but I'd say based on the problems, examples, and quotes we just saw of vestigial organs, somebody's got a vestige all right, they've got a vestigial brain cell or two, you know what I'm saying. And gee, that would make this evolution by way of vestigial organs a what? Another big fat lie. Shocker. In fact, I'd say based on this kind of track record, any kind of evolutionary mechanism they come up is with probably also going to be a lie. How about you? But you might be thinking, okay, so maybe the supposed evolution of man and animals is a bunch of baloney, and even the supposed mechanisms of natural selection, embryology, mutations, and vestigial organs are a bunch of baloney. But what are the remaining mechanisms they've come up with for evolution? You know, like transitional fossils, punctuated equilibrium, sequential ordering and all that other stuff as to how life supposedly evolved. Well, hey, great question. I guess that's what we'll take a look at in the next chapter.